so am I still waiting, waiting a long time,
waiting for tonight.
Listen to Revolver!
20 short years, the sport has come so far. 1993, UFC 1.
It's just incredible to see where the sport has evolved in such a short period of time.
I honestly didn't understand the magnitude of what it could become.
This thing is global and just getting started.
I always thought it would get here someday. I just didn't think it would be this fast.
No one knew what it was.
There may be some blood spilled. There may be some bones broken. This is real. It's live. It's brutal.
And back then, the way they were advertising, it was like somebody was going to die, something was going to happen.
To me, it was kind of legalized street fighting.
They were pitting anybody against anybody. No weight classes.
It was in a cage. They would lock the doors. No rules. I go, like, man, that sounds really dangerous. I don't know if that's a good idea.
And it punches to the back of the head a couple times.
This was like a real live blood sport.
Two pieces of flesh striking one another.
I don't think anybody understood what was ahead of us.
The promoters say the only way it ends is if a doctor intervenes, the fighter gives up, passes out, or dies on the mat.
You say it's entertainment. Feeding Christians to the lions was entertainment.
The public has an insatiable appetite for violence.
It was the Wild West, and we needed it to be wild.
I was appalled. That's not a sport. Even hardened individuals are repelled by this.
Critics claim it amounts to nothing more than a human cockfight.
It's easy to look back and say the controversy hurt. There would be no UFC today if we hadn't launched it with that controversy.
Welcome to Review Away. It's John Pollock and Wei Ting, live in taped format from the Review Away studios. How are you today, Wei?
Awesome. Amazing.
Is this a new sweater you're wearing?
It's not new. It's just one I don't wear that often.
I've never seen you wear this particular shade of brown before.
Yeah, it's a brown.
It is a V-neck?
Not that much of a V-neck.
Not like
a low-hang V-neck.
No.
But a V? It is in the shape of
a V. Definitely a V.
Yeah.
It looks nice.
Thanks.
It's great.
Great radio.
Yes. Are you excited about today's show?
Yeah. Are you?
Yeah, I am.
Why? Why do you say that with a smirk?
I'm not. I'm just...
What are you saying?
I'm exhausted right now. I'm very tired.
Really?
I feel like I just talked for like 2 hours straight about UFC.
You did, actually.
I think I did, actually.
Doing all the TV work that you do for the Fight Network?
Yeah, and now we're going to chat about more UFC.
Oh, God.
For another few hours.
I know.
I think we're going to go four today.
4 hours?
Yeah, I think so. We're going to review every single fight in UFC history, starting with UFC 1.
I don't think I have that much time.
No?
No.
Okay, well, we'll just skip then. We'll just pick the two best fights in UFC history, and then we'll get on out of here.
Okay.
Now, I was very surprised, Wei, when I said that we were going to review this. I thought we were going to get a lot of anger and hatred. I really got none. How about you?
I got a couple.
Yeah.
Maybe one guy. One guy said he was going to skip this week. He basically said, count me in as one of the many people that will be skipping this week. And as far as I know, he's the only person.
He's on an island.
Yeah. So we could talk all the shit we want about that guy. He's not going to be around.
Now, what if he sends a response to what you've said here?
Well, then he's
quite a hypocrite.
He's a hypocrite. Yeah. He's made himself a hypocrite. So we win either way.
Brilliant.
Yeah.
I love those kinds of ultimatums.
Yep.
Well, today, everyone, if you're not aware, if you've downloaded this show without checking what the file says or what the story was that you clicked on, today we are reviewing the UFC documentary Fighting for a Generation, which recently aired on Fox Sports 1. And, of course, it's timely as we're coming off the 20th anniversary show from this past Saturday night with UFC 167, a card that Wei watched.
Yeah.
Card that I watched.
Mm-hmm.
And Wei, how did you score the main event? It's been very much debated.
I scored it 48-47 for Hendricks.
Same as I.
Yep.
I think that, you know, at the time, I think people, they were just outraged that Johnny Hendricks did not win. But I think that, you know, there are people that are making a case for George St. Pierre. But I've watched that round repeatedly now. Not repeatedly. I've watched it twice. Mm-hmm. And both times I just felt, no, Johnny Hendricks won that round. I feel confident in saying.
I did just simply based on the amount of effective damage. I mean, George pressed him against the cage for a lot of that, and what did he really do? Nothing. Attempted guillotine, that really
was. And while he was pressing him against the cage, was taking some nasty elbows to the side of his head.
Yep. So, well, let's not even talk about that. I'm so sick of even hearing
about this. Going to do a minute-by-minute breakdown.
No, no,
for 25 minutes.
No, you go to it. Go to the MMA report for a full recap of that.
Yeah. Go download that. We got a phone call all the way from Korea.
Whoa.
On Saturday night.
I had some Korean food over the weekend.
Unreal. It was like we were doing the exact same thing.
Actually, it was in honor of the caller that decided to have Korean food.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, so some kimchi.
Late night order.
Yeah.
Well, that's great. You had a great UFC 167 party?
I actually went to a couple of them. I started off
Did some UFC pay-per-view hopping.
Yeah. Yeah, I actually, round by round, I went to a different place. Yeah.
Man, you're so popular. How many friends do you think you have? Over 100?
What is this? What is that? What kind of question is that?
Because I have, like, 4 friends.
I mean, they say that you can count the number of really close friends you have on one hand, and I'd probably fall into that category as well.
No way.
Yeah.
Everyone likes you. Maybe close friends, you can say that, but I don't know of anyone that doesn't like
you. Yeah, the rest are really more just acquaintances.
But you go and, like, hang out with acquaintances. You're like, oh, I haven't seen so-and-so in a long time, so I'm going to go hang out with them.
A lot of people do that.
No.
Why don't you do that?
I don't do that.
Why not?
Because it's just, I feel that, you know, there's certain people, like, bring someone up from our past. Daniel Zayants.
Yeah, I knew you were going to say that.
One of my best friends in university.
Uh-huh.
But we haven't talked now in years. And, you know, him on Facebook. Because we've grown apart. And neither of us pick up a phone to call the other. And now it would be very weird for me to say, hey, you want to go for sushi?
Wouldn't
and
be
he'd
weird.
Probably be like, I'm busy. Which is really like,
Why would you assume that he'd be busy? He'd probably be like, oh, yeah, sure, Don. I'd love to catch up.
He lives far away now. He's married.
Stop making all these excuses. So what?
Well,
it's not like he is.
Oh, it's more, I'm not putting it on him. It's more on me.
Yeah.
I'm not going to
It's a very negative attitude.
See, I look at it the other way. It's like, rather than try and, you know, keep up with all these people, it's like I got my core, and I make sure that I hang out with my core. That's why I started these podcasts, so that you and I wouldn't drift away.
Sure.
Because from university, you're my only friend remaining. I hang out with my three friends from
high
school.
Maybe you should start a podcast with Daniel Zayants.
Yeah, maybe.
Yeah.
I don't know what I'd call it.
What would you even talk about?
You know what? We'd talk about nothing, because neither of us pick up a phone to talk to the other, and we'd have no time to do a podcast
together. You don't know what you might have in common these days. Maybe he's really into coffee.
He could be, but I don't know, and nor does that necessarily bind two people together.
Yeah, coffee podcast.
Maybe I'll start a book club.
Okay. What do you read?
I don't know.
What have you been reading lately?
We can. Right now, I'm reading a book on mixed martial arts.
What book is that?
I was actually going back. I was reading some of Shooter's.
Okay.
The toughest man in the history of pro wrestling.
Okay.
It blends both worlds together.
All right. Well, good luck with that book club. That's not a bad idea. Like an MMA book club.
Yeah, that's a terrible
pro
idea. Come
club.
On, let's be honest here. Maybe when are we going to do a book review? We actually do the closest thing to what could be a book club.
Okay.
I don't think we could ever get people to read a whole book. We'd need to give them like 2 months' notice.
Yeah, it'd have to be a book that.
What was the last book you read?
Last book I read. I mean, cover to cover.
Yeah.
I'm trying to think. I'm trying to remember. I don't really read.
Do you read The Observer each week?
Books? No.
No.
I don't.
Because I feel is like a book.
That's pretty much like a
weekly
book. I'm actually trying to think of like the last novel I read. But I actually read like books just in chunks and then I put them away.
I guess you read comic books.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, that doesn't
add
really
up.
Count. Those are pictures. You know,
you're still reading.
Yeah,
you're
reading word bubbles. It's hardly reading. But the last book I picked up to read was is this book called The War of Art.
Was this book required to pass a course?
No,
this was leisure reading.
Yeah,
okay.
Actually, I heard about it on Rogan's podcast, and I decided to pick it up. It's a great book. It's just about procrastination, which myself and I'm sure a lot of other people have problems with. Yeah, it's great. I recommend that.
When was this? In the last year?
Like, last week.
Last week?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
So you're not out of the habit of reading books.
Yeah, I just don't finish them. I put them away, and then I probably don't read them again for 5 years.
I used to read at a furious pace. I used to read so many books, yeah. And it coincided, I think, with subscribing to The Observer, because that would eat up so much of my week.
Right.
Well, and I also, coupled with that, was also moving downtown where I no longer rode a subway for like 2 hours a day.
Yeah.
And go on the bus. Mm-hmm. I did so much reading there. And now I don't have that. And I find it really is difficult for me to sit down and read something. My mind's like moving so fast. I'm thinking of what I still need to do on top of this. It's like, why am I just sitting here reading? And,
yeah, I
can't, my attention span's terrible.
I have trouble reading on any type of like outdoor environment. I can't sit in the park and read. I can't sit on a subway and read simply just because there's too much going on around me in my peripheral vision, so I can't really concentrate.
You are an observer.
Yeah, I can only really concentrate when it's like, when like I'm like in front of a wall and there's like nothing else, like when I'm in like a box.
I'm trying to picture this. What would be your optimal reading environment? It sounds very,
yeah. That's
very
why I don't read
difficult.
That much.
Have you been? You know what I get now? Because I'm supporting my local newspaper industry. I've signed up for the Toronto Star's digital access, so now they send me a newspaper every Saturday, as well as you can log in. They have a paywall now.
Oh, okay. Oh, good for you. Yeah. Nice.
I've contributed my 99 cents.
Nice, great. I'm
keeping the newspaper industry alive.
Yeah, it's an industry that could definitely use it.
Could this have been better timing for the Toronto Star? They launched this paywall like a month ago. And now the biggest story in the history of Toronto politics is falling on them. Like, ever there's a time that people just can't get enough of this stuff.
Well, what are you getting from the Star that you're not getting from another source?
I like the Toronto Star. It's what I've always read.
Oh,
you can read 10 free articles a month, or you can pay for this and get unlimited access online.
Right.
See, they made the problem of, you know, they just followed suit with everybody. It's like, well, we'll just put the whole newspaper online.
Mm-hmm.
Which was like, when you're trying to sell this, it was like, well, of course newspaper sales are going to go down because there's a whole generation that doesn't really have this affinity for having the hard copy newspaper in front of them. They're just going to read it for free online. They're going to pick a few articles. And inevitably, their subscribers went down.
Mm-hmm.
What a shocking revelation.
Yeah.
I feel I could have told them this at the age of 15. Like, why would I buy a newspaper when it's for free online?
But why would you... exactly. Why would you buy it if you could get it online? Why would you even go to the Star for your news if you can get it for free elsewhere?
A lot of these now have paywalls. Globe and Mail, I think, has a paywall.
Okay. Well, I mean, I can go to TMZ and get a lot of it for free. I can go to whatever website.
Well, as I said, I'm supporting a greater cause, I
right.
feel.
Well, I'm just,
my 99 cents are going
no,
to
I
keep
think,
someone employed.
I think that's great. So it's more of a moral reason.
I think so. I don't want newspapers to disappear. I'd be very sad if that happened.
Yeah.
Or if we were down to, like, you know, there's one newspaper 10 years from now and it comes out once a week.
Yeah. We're all struggling, man. Like, TV is not a growing industry either in North America.
How you know? Depressing.
Yeah. And it's because of shit like this, like these free podcasts that we do that's crippling the industry.
I don't know if it's crippling.
We're terrible. We're giving out this free entertainment when people could be spending their money reading a newspaper right now. So stop listening. Pick up a newspaper.
Maybe we should launch a newspaper.
Sure. About
reading.
What we did on our weekends.
Yeah.
Yeah.
The weekend report.
Okay. It'll be a day 2 days late.
Perfect.
So it'll take that long to press.
It'll be timely.
Yeah. That's a great idea. Why don't we just transcribe everything that we're saying right now?
I'm waiting for someone to do it.
Yeah.
I think we could find somebody.
We'll send that out.
The the text version of Review
of
Away.
Of all this bullshit that's coming out of our mouths.
Well, let's get into the show. UFC, 20 years old.
Mm-hmm.
Wait, what was your first encounter with the UFC? When did you first discover this hybrid?
Well, my older brother had a friend... I think his name was Vince. He decided to come over to our house because we had a black box. And he was like, hey, my friend Vince wants to watch this illegal fighting this Ultimate Fighting.
And you wouldn't have anything of it, would you?
Well, I was a big wrestling fan at the time, and then this looked kind of like pro wrestling, so I decided to watch it, and it was just a very... Like, my first impressions of MMA were just, I didn't really fully understand it, because to me, real fighting was, you know, guys in colorful outfits and Irish whips and, you know, clotheslines and everything.
It's a monkey flip.
Yeah, exactly. Where's all the running around and the ropes and the you know, vomit coming
out. So how old would you have been around this time?
This might have been, like, UFC, one of the, maybe one of UFC 1 or 2.
Wow, so you would have, you saw it on pay-per-view.
Yeah. And so, we watched it, and
Jesus, you would have been like 9 or 10.
Yeah,
you would have been so confused.
Yeah, I was, and then, but I mean, the thing is, when you watch those early fights, if that's the first fight that you've ever seen, you wouldn't really know what really happened. I mean, you know, this guy in a pajama suit just finishing guys with these weird chokes that you didn't even know were chokes, these kicks coming out of nowhere, ending fights. So. I mean, I saw it. I didn't really think too much of it, but you know,
that, did your brother? Did he have any thoughts on it?
He just thought it was like kind of a neat thing. It was just at that time, it was really just more of a spectacle. Like, you know, oh, watch some guys get beaten up, and that was really it. Tank Abbott was a huge, you know, star.
And what did your brother think when you finally you now do this stuff for a living here, talking about this stuff that you guys watched together when you were like 8?
He thinks it's cool. Yeah.
Does he keep up with MMA?
No, he doesn't. He's in China right now, so no, he doesn't. But but yeah, I never really caught on with it. It's not like I followed it up until, you know, a long time. Actually, it was the law that, you know, I started listening to where, you know, and for everybody that's ever complained about why does live audio wrestling talk about MMA? I mean, MMA has been talked about on the law almost since its inception.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? And so I was actually one of those guys who, like, I didn't follow the UFC. I didn't like it when, you know, hosts and pro wrestling hosts would talk about MMA simply because I wasn't familiar with it. I wasn't, you know, I didn't know who the people were that were involved. I didn't really know the rules. I didn't really know the techniques. I just didn't follow it. But then, of course, the Ultimate Fighter came around, and that was just the perfect segue into mixed martial arts for somebody more interested in storylines and in a combat-themed environment like myself. And ever since then, I've been hooked, of course.
It's funny because I just recently got the Mid-South DVD that the WWE put out, and it's like you watch that product, it is closer to today's UFC than WWE is to Mid-South at the time. I mean, whether it was the audience and their believability, the way the characters were presented. I mean, once you get past the work and shoot difference, it's really, I think, a much more difficult for people to differentiate the two in terms of its presentation and everything. And once you get past that one barrier, it's the similarities outweigh the differences.
Yeah, in the end, it's two guys fighting for a championship on a one-on-one battle to see who's the best. You know, instead of a pinfall, of course, you have a tap-out or a submission or a knockout. And it's simple as that. You know, the rules are slightly different, but everything else is pretty similar.
I was simply just, I discovered it through, you know, usually once a week, my dad would take us to go, like, go to the local video store. And every week, I would always just go to the wrestling section and see what new stuff they would have. And I would just always rent wrestling tapes. And then suddenly, they put the UFC tapes right next to the wrestling. And it was like, all right, I've seen WrestleMania 4 about 8 times at this point. And then I looked on over, and it was like, well, this looks kind of interesting. And it was the same. It was like, this kind of looks like wrestling. And you kind of rented it, not really knowing what it was going to be. And I remember it was just, whether it was, A, the quick fights that kept your attention, you had a number of just different characters here. You had Taylor Tooley here, this gigantic sumo, getting knocked down by Gerard Gordeaux and then kicked right in the face. And then you had Ken Shamrock, which at the time that I watched it, it probably would have been before he went to the WWF. But nonetheless, I mean, had the look of what your typical professional wrestler would have been at the time. And then you had Hoist Gracie, who was the complete opposite of that, 175 pounds. And it was just something that did grab your attention. And as the events escalated, and then you incorporate characters like Chemo coming down with a cross, with Tank Abbott, as you mentioned. I mean, you had these characters that were on this, and they were doing this absolutely brutal form of fighting, which you weren't accustomed to if you were watching boxing at the time. It was so different from professional wrestling, but felt closer to pro wrestling than it did to boxing.
And it's funny watching this documentary, because a large part of it focuses on the genesis of it and what the promoters back then were thinking of trying to emulate. And it's interesting to find out that Mortal Kombat was one of the influences. You know, you take a video game where everybody kind of has their own style, and you put them together to see who is the ultimate champion.
I remember in fourth grade, I brought my WWF magazine to school, and it's so weird to look back, but it's like it's got Lex Luger on the front with like these tight jeans and no shirt, and he's posing on the front.
Yeah.
This looks ridiculous.
Yeah.
And then on the back, there was an ad for Mortal Kombat, and I remember showing it to my buddy, and the teacher took my magazine away.
Ooh.
Because it was promoting Mortal Kombat.
Oh.
Which was like the taboo game back in 93, 94. And it was considered like, man, kids are going to start trying to perform fatalities on each other and stuff. Like, just ridiculous shit. Like, yeah. I'm going to freeze you or something. Like, I think sometimes even impressionable youth are not given enough credit of what they can decipher as fantasy and reality. But nonetheless, that's a different... But fucking stole my magazine and put it, like, under their desk or into, like, one of their desk units or something. So I remember, like, 2 days later, I went and I stole my magazine. I'm like, you're not fucking taking my WWF magazine. Like, you only get one of these a month? And it's like, I would read that thing cover to cover.
You got balls, man. Good for you. Get that back. She kept it and she didn't give it back.
She put it away. I'm like, she's not even going to remember she has that magazine.
Yeah.
And it's like, I don't give a fuck if you have a problem with Mortal Kombat.
It was just an ad.
It was an ad.
Yeah.
And it was like, no, we are not promoting that video game. I'm like, I'm not promoting shit here. Yeah. Anyway.
Bitch.
What a jerk. Anyway, so that was my Mortal Kombat story. But yeah, absolutely. At this time, really, if you want to trace the infancy, the seed that was planted for the UFC, it came with Playboy. Because there was a famous article in a 1989 edition that Art Davey just happened to be perusing for whatever reason, and he read this article entitled Bad, and it was all about Horion Gracie and Gracie Jiu-Jitsu. This was in 1989, so something that was completely, you know, this thing in another part of the world that was going on, and here's a fighting system that the larger public has no familiarity with. And Art Davey, that kind of planted the idea of getting in touch with Horion and coming up with a concept. And Horion was coming with it from the side of, you know, getting a larger vehicle to promote Gracie Jiu-Jitsu. Like, they had their Gracie in Action tapes, and they were all about selling Gracie Jiu-Jitsu. And Art Davey kind of modified it, where what if we take all these different disciplines? And Horion went along with that, believing that, you know, if we have, this could be a great demonstration for our discipline, in that we can prove that Jiu-Jitsu is effective against a boxer, and that was the reasoning for Art Jimerson, and getting all these different styles together. And the original name was going to be called War of the Worlds, and it led to, they went to all these pay-per-view companies, they were turned down, and then eventually approached... War of the Worlds was what it was going to be called.
It would be WOW.
WOW. We could have been just coming off of WOW 167.
Yeah. Not really.
That would probably be like a tagline of Mike Goldberg for a stunning finish. Wow. Wow. Bruce Buffer gets it in. And now, it's time for WOW. Don't know if it would have had the same punch.
Yeah, I don't know. And I don't know if, Women of Wrestling would have been happy about that.
Oh, they would have been furious. They would have had to, you know, Ultimate Female Championships they would have taken.
Oh, yes.
Yeah. UFC would have been a terrible 2001 pay-per-view.
Yeah.
So... eventually, they approached Semaphore Entertainment Group, which is where Bob Meyerowitz came into the picture, Campbell McLaren, who was the original executive producer, and they had promoted all of these concerts on pay-per-view, and because of the success of one of their shows, they were able to bankroll this. They were trying to come up with new pay-per-view ideas, and ones where, unlike the musical acts that they promoted, they didn't own that content. They didn't own the music or the artists. With the UFC, they would be able to own the content and really make something of it, and that led to that first show, November the 12th, 1993, in Denver, Colorado, and it was really just promoted as there were no rules, which wasn't actually accurate. There were some rules in place. They didn't allow groin strikes. There technically were rounds.
When did they allow groin strikes?
The second show. They were like, yeah, let's allow them. You know what? They weren't even a big deal in the first one.
Anyway.
The second one was actually more brutal than the first show.
Oh, yeah.
And that led to that pay-per-view. But you look at the time of, you know, they didn't have television to promote this. And this thing did 86,000 buys on pay-per-view. And they talk about this in the documentary, the fact that as much as the original version of the UFC sometimes gets painted with a bad brush, if they hadn't gone the shock route, this thing would have died right out of the gate. They wouldn't have got, I think, to show number three had they just gone with the idea of a sport and presenting it as clean. Like today's version of UFC, it just wouldn't have grabbed people's attention back in 1993. So it was kind of a catch-22 in the fact that it gained all this curiosity, and that led to that early period of gigantic success on pay-per-view.
Do you really believe that, though? Do you believe that it, without the controversy, without advertising it as, you know, a no-rules, you know, blood sport type of thing, that it wouldn't have survived based on simply, you know, the curiosity of, you know, somebody versus somebody else?
I really think that there was that morbid curiosity that drew a lot of people in. I think simply, you know, wrestler. I mean, they did kind of mixed fights over the past. I mean, Gene LaBelle did one on national television. I mean, it was just I just feel that a lot of it was the idea of just there are no rules, and it was, I mean, people were not familiar with these names going into that first show at all. I mean, you had no stars at the time. It was really the concept, and I think that had a huge part to play in just the curiosity and the way that they marketed it and the way that they went out and said that, you know, fights can end in potentially death. I mean, that really would hurt them later. But at the time, I certainly think that there was a curiosity. I mean, your brother's friend said, hey, there's these illegal fights going on. I mean, it wasn't, hey, man, we're going to find out who's better between taekwondo and karate tonight. That's certainly interesting. But I think that it was, the way it was marketed led to a lot of their curiosity.
Mm-hmm.
So the show, the documentary way as a whole, it's kind of interesting to look that today those figures from the early days, your Campbell McLaren's, Bob Meyerowitz, Art Davey, David Isaacs, they're really presented now in glowing terms by today's UFC. And that wasn't always the case. It used to be, you know, they ran from regulation, and the Zuffa tried to really distance themselves and maybe kind of had to establish how different they were and establishing themselves with different commissions. But today, now the narrative is, you know, without these guys, this thing wouldn't have made it, which is true.
Well, I would question how early that started to change, because in my opinion, I mean, just knowing what I know about those guys, I felt like their opinion, the public opinion on SCG in general was not that great up until this documentary.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like, until this documentary where you get to hear from those guys finally, and they were portrayed, I would say, actually, at the beginning of this documentary, like, they were portrayed sort of like, you know, the guys who fucked it up. They were portrayed as the guys who, you know, went that route and actually made a lot of terrible business decisions and made a lot of work for everybody to overcome afterwards. But at the end of it, they have the argument that if we did not do that, none of this would be around. You know, if we did not promote it as a violent thing where anything could happen, there would be no George St. Pierre, there would be no, you know, Anderson Silva, there would be no forum simply for any of this to take place. So they are, at the end of this documentary, kind of heralded as, you know, the founders who, you know, did what they had to do.
Yeah, and it was just as well, I mean, also the time period where I think that it was just, it did connect with people at that time. I would be curious if something like this came along today. I don't think you really would have the shock value, and I don't think this thing would find that success like they did in 1993. A lot of it was just the time that they came around at, that people were very interested in this, you know, style of violence.
Yeah. Well, we had bum fights, and we had, what is it, that, like the Kimbo Slice deals.
Yeah, absolutely.
Do you think those could have grown into a UFC?
Well, hey, I mean, Kimbo Slice absolutely transferred over to becoming someone that people wanted to see, and that was only back in 2008 when he got on CBS, did a monstrous number, and it was really based on that off of YouTube videos and curiosity.
Like, actually, the YouTube, like street fights are more popular now than ever, I would say. Because, I mean, you can see them every single day online. Like, WorldStar is just so popular right now.
Well, I think there's also a certain level of interest when you see non-trained fighters fighting, where it's just no technique. There's just the potential for danger is so much higher than two guys that are, you know, rounded in every discipline, know how to fight. I mean, there's a certain level of intrigue to, you know, two guys at a bar that get into a fight.
Oh, it's a car crash.
It is. It is. The question being, would people pay for that today? Maybe. I don't know. It's hard to say.
I don't know.
What did you think in terms of this?
They would pay for it, but they certainly wouldn't be gathered in bars. They wouldn't be attending a 60,000-seated arena to watch something like that. It'd be something that you'd be kind of embarrassed about.
You don't think that a one-night tournament where $1 million goes to the winner could be a viable idea? The best of the barroom brawlers?
Are you talking about the UFC? Like the UFC 1?
Yeah, I'm just saying a similar idea today where you take largely untrained fighters and put them on pay-per-view.
Yeah, I don't think so.
I don't think it would either.
No.
I really enjoyed kind of the early look at the UFC on this documentary. I mean, it kind of morphed into the Zuffa, I guess, sales video by the end of the final 20 minutes.
We just watched that Triple H documentary, and definitely towards the end. Like, any time you have a documentary made about the people that are financing it, did they finance it? Was this a Zuffa production?
Yes.
Yeah. So anytime,
they hired a company to put it together.
Basically, anytime you hire somebody to make a documentary about yourselves, it's going to be hard to not come across like, you know, you're paying for a blowjob here, and that's definitely what it came across towards the end of it. But I will say, you know, especially with the segment talking about SEG and giving a voice to all these people that they didn't really have to, I thought gave a pretty balanced look. I mean, like, Tito was in this.
Yeah, and I'm curious when that interview would have been done and how long the production went. Like, this very well could have been while Tito was still on relatively good terms with the UFC and obviously before he went to Bellator. I can't fathom that this interview took place after he joined Bellator and probably was over a year ago.
Right.
But, sure, he's one that jumps out. I did think it was a disservice to this documentary that, you know, a lot of key names were not spoken to. I mean, and the fact is, it just, we knew going in, you weren't going to hear from Randy Couture, you weren't going to hear from Ken Shamrock, and Frank Shamrock may as well not even exist in UFC history, which I think is an oversight, where you're really not telling the story of the UFC and how they got through those dark days. It was largely on that guy's shoulders, who was at least someone that kept the most ardent fan coming back towards during a time when they were shut out of many major pay-per-view outlets. I mean, Frank Shamrock was that lone hope at the time, and nothing in this documentary.
Yeah, nor Randy Couture.
Yeah, Randy Couture, which to me is, I don't see the need that, you know, if you're telling a larger story, why those kind of vendettas should get in the way of something. And to me, it's petty, and you're downgrading your own history. Mm-hmm. I mean, say what you will, if the WWE were to do a retrospective on WrestleMania, they're not, and WWE is not the best example when it comes to editorial control and telling, you know, the real story about things, but you're not taking out Hulk Hogan. And I think that's what you're essentially doing when A Randy Couture is very much minimized. Even Ken Shamrock. I mean, that guy was responsible for not just the first explosion on pay-per-view, but the second as well.
Yep.
And in between that time, did the first fight with Tito Ortiz in 2002, which was the show that was the first time Zuffa went over 100,000 buys and kept the Fertittas in this game, knowing, well, if we do have the right fight, there is an audience for this. That UFC 40 show was so important in their history.
Do you think they would have, like somebody like Ken Shamrock or Frank would have agreed to do this if they were asked?
Yes, I think they would have. I think absolutely they would have. I think Ken Shamrock is not shy about talking to anybody. I think at worst, you're going to get a guy who's going to be a bit critical, but I think I would at least want to hear from those early days, because, you know, outside of the giant omissions of some of those guys we just listed, I mean, they went to a lot of lengths here to find guys, people that you haven't heard from in a long time. Horyon Gracie was interviewed. They interviewed John McCain for this thing.
Yes.
Who is a huge part of UFC history.
Yes.
He was, of course, you know, really spearheaded the campaign to get the pay-per-view providers to cut out the UFC. He personally contacted the government in Puerto Rico when they were going to be running a show to try and get it shut down. And the UFC, they were able to run that show in Puerto Rico, but never came back afterwards. And then it was after UFC 9, which is a really important show in company history, because that was the show in Detroit where you had Ken Shamrock and Dan Severn. And during the day, they were in court all day trying to get the show going ahead. You had 11,000 tickets that had been sold for this at Cobo Arena, and they had to institute these weird rules at the last minute, including no closed fists. And this prompted Ken Shamrock, he was not going to break these rules for fear he would be arrested if he did so. And the result was a horrendous fight with Dan Severn in front of there was a huge purchases on pay-per-view for this card. And then afterwards, that was when they were removed from pay-per-view up here in Canada, which was a quarter of their business. They were taken off Cablevision, TCI, and that was really the end of that 93 to 95 kind of glory period on pay-per-view, where they were making a lot of money off of these pay-per-views at this point. And when you cut out so much of your business at that point, that kind of sped things up into the dark days.
Yeah, I thought it was amazing that they got John McCain in this, because I really can't think of somebody who's been a bigger adversary to the company than, you know, somebody like a senator. And to have him in this, first of all, I think about what's really in it for him. But then I think about the portrayal that they did give to him. And by the end of this documentary, I mean, he's really just a guy who just said, like, even if you're an MMA fan, you might be like, oh, you know, this jerk trying to, prohibit us from watching what we love. But then he makes a great case that he was only wanting to ensure the safety of the participants, and that's all he wanted. And then once these rule changes came into play and the UFC started to become a more of a regulated sport, he started to accept it. And I think what better advertisement for, you know, how far the UFC has come than to have your biggest adversary come back in your documentary and basically say, yeah, the sport is, you know, I'm a fan now.
Yeah, there were a number of key kind of retrospectives on this, because at the time, not only did you have John McCain very much opposed to the UFC, you also had Mark Ratner, who was then the head of the Nevada State Athletic Commission, who was also extremely opposed to the UFC at the time. There was a very famous segment on CNN where Bob Meyerowitz and Ken Shamrock were on with Larry King debating with McCain and Mark Ratner, and you can even watch that segment online today. And now you look at it, and it's very much different now.
He works for the UFC.
Yeah, Mark Ratner was hired in 2006 as their VP of Regulatory Affairs, a huge hire for the company. And he just simply said that he wanted to see changes and didn't view it as a sport at the time, but eventually did somewhat come around. But for so long, it was kind of presented that, you know, SEG, they ran from regulation, they didn't want rules, and that just wasn't the case. They instituted mm-hmm. weight classes on their own, they brought rounds into it, there were absolutely rules that were added over event by event. Like, you have to remember, they were also starting this thing from scratch, essentially, and each event... There would be, who could have predicted that Tank Abbott was going to try and lift Cal Worsham and throw him over the cage, and they had to increase the height of the cage as a result. Like, mm-hmm. going into it, you wouldn't think that that was something.
I love the section in this documentary where Big John McCarthy basically lines out all the reasons for the current rules that we have today. One of them, you know, no fish hooking, no knees to a downed opponent, and then, you know, no lifting an opponent through the cage. And I would count maybe like at least half of these rules were a result of something Tank Abbott did.
Yeah, Tank Abbott. I wish that they had interviewed him. He's not someone that you figure is not on bad terms with the UFC, and I would have loved to have heard from him, because you're right, he was the perpetrator of a lot of these rule changes at the time.
Lifting a guy through a cage, like a Royal Rumble.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Like, he was going to toss him right over the top.
Who would have won? Who would have won in that?
Again, you have no precedent for that, so I that would have been a curious call. Had he got this man successfully over the top of the cage, would there have been a restart? Would he have been concussed?
Would they continue the fight?
He might not have been able to continue if he landed on a bunch of reporters at cage side. So we didn't hear from Tank Abbott. There were a lot of people, actually, media members that were interviewed for this that didn't make the cut, but thankfully we got to hear from both Anthony Kiedis and Mixmaster Mike.
But you know what? I know what you're trying to say, but it's important, because it's important to have celebrities there to show how mainstream you are, and just to, you know, show how globally accepted you are when, you know, somebody
Do you sit back and say, wow, when you see David Spade is talking about your
product?
Not
David Spade, but Anthony Kiedis, yeah, I do. Seriously. Not only the fact that, you know, he's a fan of the UFC, but he seems extremely, extremely knowledgeable about the sport.
I thought Mike Tyson being in there played more to that than hearing from David Spade about the history of
David
the UFC.
David Spade only had, one line?
He was in there a little bit.
He didn't really have that much to say.
I know that Dave Meltzer has kind of outlined he had a lot of technical issues and thus couldn't get in.
He would have added a lot.
I think he would have added so much to this documentary. I think it was really unfortunate that they weren't able to connect and talk on this documentary, because I think Dave Meltzer, he was one of the few reporters at the time covering the UFC. It's amazing to go back into his back issues and read his report on UFC 1. Mm-hmm. I mean, he's been covering this thing from the start, and it was in constant contact with Campbell McLaren and David Isaacs, and I think would be one of the... you know, maybe three most knowledgeable people when it comes to the history of the UFC. And
who are the other three?
I would put Joe Silva in there, and on top of that, maybe the two most. To me, I wanted to hear from Dave Meltzer, Joe Silva, Clyde Gentry, who has written numerous books on the history of the UFC. Those would have been three from a historical perspective, and Big John McCarthy, who was in the documentary.
Yes.
I would say those four would be my go-to people for a historical and balanced perspective. I mean, you kind of have... I know Joe Silva is with the company, but outside of that, I think you get a really balanced look at things.
Yep.
And as well, it's not really... You know, the SEG era, I felt we got a much more balanced look at, because it's not attached to Zuffa. And there wasn't a pressure to paint a certain picture of anything. I think you could be a lot more honest with that version of history, because that was the preceding company.
Yeah, I felt like, at least to me, you know, it felt like they were trying to hide away from that whole SEG era for much of their current existence. You know, not even wanting to show some of the footage from back then, because nobody wants, you know, those comparisons made to this day. But they certainly weren't shy about showing a lot of the brutal knockouts and a lot of the, you know, ridiculous things that used to happen in back in the day. So I found that very interesting. It's really, like, you watch a lot of these, like, ultimate knockouts, like these compilation shows, and they rarely go to some of these older fights with crazy, you know, no rules and everything. So it was nice to see that part of their history acknowledged here.
Yeah, and it's also, you know, and... It's hard because, you know, we're looking at it from just a historical perspective of, you know, just telling the real story. And for Zuffa, I mean, they came into this thing when it was just no one wanted to touch this thing, and it was just, it had a very negative connotation to it amongst a lot of commissions, to a lot of people in powerful positions, and it was to their benefit at the time to really distance themselves from the old UFC. They were trying to create as much distance as possible, and it, you know, you can look back now at quite the turnaround they have made, but you also see it from their perspective. They were not running this thing as journalists telling the history of MMA. They were a business that were trying to distance themselves from what was they deemed a spectacle, and now we are presenting a sport. And that was, you know, what fueled them. And, you know, to understand that perspective, I mean, that's where they're coming from.
At the same time, you know, by the time that the Fertittas and Dana came around, the sport had begun to evolve. The sport had not, you know, it was no longer simply style versus style. Like, MMA was actually becoming a thing on its own. And I think that's where the trend was leading to. That's what the company at that point became. It wasn't just freak show fights. It was an actual sport, and it was very interesting to hear about the Fertittas talk, because you rarely see them talk about anything in interviews.
Oh, Frank Fertitta, he's the ghost of those three. Yep. I mean, you never see him around.
And they were basically saying how, you know, Meyerowitz was basically gave up only the letters, the brand of the UFC. That's all he really had to his name, and that was, what was it, a $2 million sale?
$2 million.
Just for the letters UFC, and for some reason, I guess it's chump change to guys like the Fertittas, but bought it and then took on, you know, a real challenge.
Yeah, I know that whenever Bob Meyerowitz is interviewed, he always has talked, he's always asked, you know, You look at how big it is now. Do you regret it? And it's just, it's such an unfair question.
No way would he regret it. Come on. The guy was in so much debt at the time.
That's the problem, is like, everyone kind of glosses over the fact that from 2001, when the Fertittas bought this thing, up until they were profitable 4 years later in 2005, when stuff started clicking, I mean, that was $44 million later. Yeah. Bob Meyerowitz didn't have another 44. I don't think he had another $4 million to put into this thing. He may not have even had another million to put into this. So the alternative was not, hey, just keep throwing bad money after good. Good money after bad, I think, is the saying. Mm-hmm. And, I mean, the UFC would have died.
Yep.
There was really no one else out there that was going to take this thing on at the time. And I think Bob Meyerowitz just wanted to get out at this point. That guy sunk in so much money to this thing. And at this point, Campbell McLaren had left. David Isaacs had left. Art Davey had left. The new matchmaker was John Peretti at the time. That it was just, like, there was no hope for this thing. And the Fertittas coming in, along with Dana White, they were able to at least hit the reset button. And that's when they got back onto pay-per-view up here in Canada. I remember that first show back. It was UFC 30. Mm-hmm. And I ordered that show, I remember. It was back when they were on Friday nights. And it was Tito Ortiz and Evan Tanner in the main event. And I don't know what exactly it was that led me to buy that show. It might have been just listening to The Law and stuff, that I was a big fan of the UFC back when I watched it, but I really had no outlet to watch it during 97, 98, 99, 2000. We didn't get it on pay-per-view up here. It's not like they were releasing tapes up here, so you couldn't even keep up with it. And the internet was still, I mean, I didn't even get the internet till like 1999. So it was like very much incredibly difficult to follow at this time. And I thought, this is a good jumping on point. This was like Peter Parker's death. It was my jumping on point.
That's it.
Superior UFC.
Yes, exactly. But you think about the situation that the company was in at the time, and how lucky they were to have these millionaires who are fans wanting to buy into the company and somehow keep it alive. It's a very similar situation to what we constantly see in pro wrestling when companies go under. And then, you know, like a TNA, for instance, the Carters buying into it and basically pumping a lot of money into it, trying to resuscitate it. And it really wasn't until they had that hit with The Ultimate Fighter that things started to click. And you wonder, you know, what can pro wrestling companies like a TNA take from this? What can they take from, you know, these lessons to see a success story actually, you know, come up from near bankruptcy?
Yeah, and it's really interesting because at the time, you know, The Ultimate Fighter wasn't even what they wanted. Like, their big goal was to get, because the Fertittas and Dana White, they came from much more of, you know, modeling this thing after boxing. Though Lorenzo, he said when he first bought the company, the first thing he did was download all the WWE's financials because they wanted to take the WWE's business model and take kind of the sport aspect of boxing and kind of meld it together. And if you look at the UFC's, you know, kind of track record, where it's exactly the same as the WWE's, where first we get television in a region of the world, then that leads to the live event coming to that part of the world and trying to spread it that way and going television first, live event second. And it's been very successful for the WWE, who, I mean, they are in a position where even if pay-per-view falls to a drastically low level, they have television licensing, they have touring, they have all these different revenue generators, which the UFC is still, I think, in its infancy towards, of really creating all those different pillars of revenue and kind of getting much more diversified like the WWE is. But the original idea was they wanted to have something like Tuesday Night Fights, where every week they would present live fights on television. And Spike wasn't interested in that, but they were interested in a reality show. Mm-hmm. And I think that that was so important because I don't think a live fight special at that point in time in history would have gotten a tenth of the recognition that The Ultimate Fighter did. You needed to know who these people were sport where people didn't know anybody for the large part.
Not only did you need to know who the personalities were, you needed to know what the sport was, what the rules of the sport was. And coming from somebody like myself, pro wrestling fan who didn't really watch MMA, I mean, I remember when UCC used to be on TSN, they would just throw those things up.
Yep.
And I'd try to watch it, and I'd be like, I don't know what the fuck's going on. What the hell's going on? When they're jumping into the ground, and this guy's wrapping his legs around the dude's head, and the fight's over? I don't understand it. There's a huge educational gap to get into the sport, and somehow this reality show was the perfect vehicle to carry out the personalities, to carry out the rules of the fights, and also to carry out just the emotion and the drama that it takes to even get to that fight day. That's what really succeeded about the show, in my opinion.
Yeah, I remember that first night that it debuted. It was January 17th of 2005, and we all went to Raw that night in Toronto.
Mm-hmm.
And then I came home that night, and I rode my bike home and got frostbite, as I recall, and got home. My ear was a mess from riding my bike in, like, the frigid cold. And as I'm, like, applying, like, hot water to my ear that's, like, swollen from frostbite, I watched the first episode of The Ultimate Fighter. And I just watched that first episode. I'm like, this was really good.
Yeah.
And it was a couple of weeks later when they set up the Chris Lieb and Josh Koscheck fight. It was like, this is going to be massive.
Oh,
like,
dude,
that show ended, and I was like, oh my God, we got to wait a week for this fight, for a taped fight.
I definitely remember Chris Lieb being the breakout star, the first breakout star of that series. And that came from the spritzing on Jason Thacker's pillow.
Yes.
one of those infamous moments.
But that will be the legacy of Jason Thacker.
Yeah, but even simply, getting to see, I remember seeing Bobby Southworth trying to make weight. That was like the first introduction I think the world had to what it takes to for a guy to make weight and just how difficult everything was. And man, I really think we have to applaud, you know, Craig Piligian and the producers of that show for treating the show as well as they did, because they could have simply went, you know, the violent route, you know, the route where, oh, come see it, a brutal knockout with these two, with these bunch of thugs. They could have gone the reality show route where you only had guys who were based off of personalities. And they talk about this in the documentary, how the producers only want their first things, the Spike people, they wanted to find people that had personality first. But Dana came in and said, we actually need guys who could fight. And that, to me, is the difference between a show like The Ultimate Fighter and a show like Tough Enough, where you have complete unknowns who amount to nothing. I mean, you have a guy like Maven who, you know, you might be the best amongst a group of nobodies.
And that was like kind of, you know, for people that were following the sport and watching, you know, guys like Diego Sanchez and Forrest Griffin and knew that these guys did have legit backgrounds, there were new fans that were wondering, are these just reality stars that are going to just get exposed once they make it into the UFC?
Because that was the trend for reality TV.
One of the key things that I think is underplayed is the fact that not only did you have a really captivating season with personalities, but when they made the leap into the UFC,
they were able to hang because you had, it's not like you had all these promotions spread out going after all these prospects. You had the cream of the crop at your disposal here to bring in Josh Koscheck, Diego Sanchez, Griffin, Bonner, Florian.
Like, all of a sudden, you had a vehicle to promote, to give airtime, and basically, this original cast had more TV time than anybody who was on your current roster, more than Rich Franklin, more than, you know, maybe aside from Ken Shamrock, more than anybody at the time. And it really, I'm sure, helped the company to have all these guys stick around afterwards and be competitive. I mean, it's not so much the case anymore. A guy from the Ultimate Fighter might not do, although with the women, you know, that might be different. But for a typical season, you're not going to get a guy who's really going to stick around for too long. But at the time, I'm sure it helped a lot. I thought it was really interesting how they even met Craig Piligian, because I didn't know that the Fertittas themselves were in a reality show.
I had no clue before this documentary that they were in that.
They were in a 3-season-long reality show about casino owners called American Casino.
Yeah, which I would love to go back and watch.
Yeah,
I think it would be really fascinating.
Mm-hmm.
I had no clue about that story either. But it was just really the presentation of that show. I mean, everything, like, it looked clean, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like, it was not shot, like, in a dingy gym.
Yep.
It was, like, bright colors. You had Randy Couture and Chuck Liddell, who as your captains, you were trying to, that was building up their fight alone. So it was dual purpose here of introducing these new stars and building to a pay-per-view as well between these two.
It was just amazing because, I mean, yeah, we watched Survivor, we watched Big Brother. At the end of the show, the big climax is, okay, a vote. But in this, not only do you get to know the personalities of the two people that, you know, are featured that week, you get to see them in a fight. Like, what other TV show will provide that to you?
Which I think today's fan can't appreciate, that a fight on free television at the time was extremely novel.
Or let's even take, you know, the UFC out of the equation here, and let's just say this is a reality show where two guys live in a house. At the end, they're going to participate in a fight. Like, how crazy is that, and how awesome is that? It was a concept that really worked. I was surprised, though, that the fighters themselves didn't know that they were going to fight multiple times.
Yeah, that kind of has never really been explored, because everyone remembers Dana White's infamous speech, but this documentary was the first time a certain context was given to that, in that the fighters showed up not even kind of knowing what the reality show was going to be.
They thought they were just going to fight at the end of the season one time.
Yeah, are we just here to, you know, stay on weight and we're going to fight at the end once? And it was kind of an interesting behind-the-scenes look at that first season and kind of developing things as we go. And there were so many things about that first season.
My questions were, like, legally, how can he do this? Can he be like, you guys are going to fight, I don't give a shit? Because these are all technically exhibition matches, so, like, what are the legal terms for that?
Yeah, there's nothing holding them legally to have to fight, but all of them stuck around and all of them did it.
Like, they really use that loophole of MMA exhibition matches to their advantage for this show, because there's no difference between an exhibition fight and a real fight.
No, it was just
the rounds, that's all.
Yeah, it was 2 5-minute rounds instead of 3. But also from that first season, you also had they ditched this, but originally the host, do you remember Willa Ford?
I do.
The host?
I was going to say, why didn't we hear from her?
We didn't hear from her. And the challenges, which remember though, that there were hardcore fans that just hated those challenges.
Like, hearing some of the perspectives on this documentary, like, I have no doubt that it was probably like a Spike TV or you know, even a Craig Piligian, like, TV decision.
You need a challenge. It's a reality show.
Bullshit thing.
And those quickly, once they realize, all right, the UFC here has a lot of power coming out of this first season, we can negotiate the production of this of the second season, which was to come. But of course, it led up to the now infamous fight with Forrest Griffin and Stephen Bonner. And at this point, you know, the second season was a go, and now they were all of a sudden, not only were you drawing people to the television show, and a big part of that was following Raw on Spike.
That's it. Yeah, that's the other thing I felt like deserved some mention in this documentary.
A huge mention.
For whatever reason, obviously, they didn't get into that. But, hey, I mean, it hooked a fan like me to stick around after Raw and basically drew me from being a more, you know, primarily pro wrestling fan into almost more of an MMA fan than I was at pro wrestling at one point. And not just me, but a lot of others. I mean, talk about how many people who we work with that, you know, you ask them, do you still watch wrestling? Well, I used to. Now I'm an MMA fan.
Yeah.
Like, it's a story you hear all the time, and I have no doubt it's because of, you know, this show following Raw.
Yeah, it was cannot be understated, and it certainly
like,
was.
It
on
just
the
came at a time when like pro what year did the Ultimate
2005.
Okay, but it just came at like a time when pro wrestling was getting more and more fake. And I think the world was clamoring for a more realistic version of pro wrestling, and this happened to fit that, you know, that appetite.
Mm-hmm. So at this point, on top of that, you also, that Randy Couture-Chuck Liddell fight did tremendously well, over 300,000 buys at the time. And even you even knew the telltale sign, because midway through the season, they had a pay-per-view headlined by Tito Ortiz and Vitor Belfort that did shockingly well. And you have to attribute the success the Ultimate Fighter was getting just a couple weeks in. This was the Super Bowl weekend. This would have been 3 weeks into mm-hmm. the reality series, and you did a good number on pay-per-view, and then Randy and Chuck did. And this is when the pay-per-view business really was taking off, and then would just hit another level in 2006 when you had Matt Hughes and Hoyce Gracie. Mm-hmm. When that came out that did 600,000 buys, I was stunned. Just stunned. And then the second Shamrock Tito fight the following month did 775,000 buys. Mm-hmm. I mean, they just became a pay-per-view juggernaut in 2006, and that would really continue really right through 2010 and the Brock Lesnar period. But, I mean, you can all kind of circulate it towards that 2005 growth period.
Yeah, they devoted a segment of this show basically towards all the stars that ended up, you know, all the champions and all the quote-unquote eras that ended up happening in the UFC. And, you know, mention was given to, of course, Chuck Liddell, George St. Pierre, Anderson Silva. But like we mentioned, nothing really to Randy, nothing really, they would talk about Brock, but that was more about like UFC 100. But do you feel like there was anybody else missing that they should have, noted?
The key ones to me were both Shamrocks and Randy Couture. Like, to this day, if you ask me your favorite UFC moment, it was Randy Couture beating Tim Sylvia mm-hmm. at UFC 68. Like, that will go down to me as my favorite MMA moment ever. It was just the most incredible story that this guy's coming out of retirement, beats Tim Sylvia.
At the age of what, 42, 45?
I think he was 43, I'm guessing. It would have been 2007. I mean, it's just, if you go back and watch that fight, I don't think you'll be able to appreciate it. It wasn't a great fight. That was all context of the time.
Absolutely.
And it was just the most exciting 25 minutes, and the whole arena in Columbus counting down as that fifth round ended.
Yeah.
I was just like, this is one of the most incredible sports moments I've ever watched.
Yeah, just think about the odds that are against this guy. He's coming up a weight class to face a guy much bigger than him. He's way older than this guy. He hasn't fought in such a long time, and goes on to defeat the guy through tact, like through technique.
Yeah, it was just an incredible moment, and yeah, that was my biggest issue with this documentary, was just glossing over some really key figures. I mean, Frank Shamrock, I don't think there was even a screenshot of this man throughout this hour and a half documentary. Mm-hmm. And I think that probably, at least up until the time in 1999, that was their biggest fight in history. Not business-wise, but him and Tito Ortiz at UFC 22... up to that point in time, that was the best fight in UFC history. If you go back and watch that, where Tito just gassed in the fourth round, and Frank Shamrock, I mean, it was just an incredible display. And then afterwards, saying he's stepping away, he's retiring, very much reminiscent of how the 20th anniversary ended.
There you go.
George St. Pierre.
And then there's a big section about the, basically, UFC is doing really well. Now they're in a position to buy out their competition.
Yeah, this was kind of just discussed at the end, and it's some kind of strange logic where they just said, well, there's all these great fighters out there, so we're just going to buy out these companies. And to me, it was the Pride sale was always the weirdest one, because they spent, you know, the rumored sale price was just a ridiculous figure of like $70 million. Mm. And you still had to sign these guys to contracts. Mm-hmm. So it's like,
What are you buying here?
The most expensive tape library in history, apparently, which has really not been monetized to any degree. They had that Spike show briefly that Kenda Perez hosted, but it's not like, apparently, still the network in Japan still has the rights to a lot of the footage and stuff like that, and that's prevented the UFC from being able to release DVDs. And
really,
it seems like there's just, it's just like, sounds like a horrendous deal that they got at the time. And you could have essentially let this company just die and pick up the fighters that you want. But all of them had different cases. Like, first there was the WFA, which ran a pay-per-view in August 2006, one which I remember ordering. And they bought out that company pretty much to get Quinton Jackson, who was under contract, and Lyoto Machida at the time, who was also under contract. That brought them in. With the WEC, it was more a strategic deal because at the time, the IFL, the International Fight League, they were close to getting a deal with the Versus Network, and the UFC didn't want them to get that spot. And because their Spike contract had exclusivity when it came to cable, the UFC couldn't get the Versus contract, so they bought the WEC to put them on Versus and effectively block out the IFL. We went over Pride, and then, of course, the Strikeforce deal in 2011, which was, you know, they had these ideas of keeping Strikeforce running. Maybe we could do supercards, and it just wasn't going to work.
No.
I just think that people didn't want to see two brands. They wanted to see one uniform organization with all the talent in one organization. And I just don't think you can effectively run two companies.
No, I don't think that works. I mean, it did work at a time with the WEC, but then I think they quickly realized, why are we, you know, not using these guys on
why are we not
brand?
Using the brand that sells to get these fighters more popular? Why are we handicapping ourselves by using a brand that, listen, outside of, you know, a hardcore base, they're not as familiar with WEC as they are with UFC. We have the big brand. Mm-hmm. Let's brand everyone by those letters.
Yep.
So I thought that was, you know, amalgamating the two was just, to me, a matter of time before they would do that. And as we mentioned, kind of the end is looking ahead to just, it's a lot of just feel-good moments for the UFC, and the last 20 minutes, it does somewhat get into UFC Triple H territory, I should say. And looking
That's to be expected. You need to close.
They looked at UFC 100, UFC 129, which you attended at the Rogers Center. I did not.
Oh, sorry.
Did you enjoy the show?
It was amazing, man. I just remember sitting up there, you know, with the other cameras and just looking from above at the incredible crowd that was there, and I still remember it to this day, especially that Mark Hominick moment, which I'm sure you know any Canadian watching at the time will remember forever. But yeah, just a massive sea of people all here because there's just so much desire for the UFC to be in town and finally hit that whole weekend with you know the expo and everything. It was a big deal. Do you think that they'll ever do another stadium show?
I think they will. I definitely think they will. I think, though, you really need a big fight to get to that level again. I don't know.
But, you know, St. Pierre Shields was not a big fight.
It wasn't, but I think, granted, you did have George St. Pierre, but I think a lot of that, too, was just there was such a pent-up demand for the UFC. I think just the UFC sold a lot of tickets that night alone, regardless of the card. Obviously not enough to fill a stadium, but, I mean, there was just such a gigantic demand for that show. I think that if they had put more tickets than 55,000 on sale, I don't think they would have had any issue selling them.
Do you think they're, I mean, why are they so hesitant to run a stadium show in the U.S.?
I think that it's just, Dana has always been extremely hesitant to run those big shows.
He was very hesitant about UFC 129.
He was very much. I mean, typically we're used to promoters just that, you know, they can sell anything. Dana's always been like, are we going to be able to fill that? Will it look bad if we can't fill a whole stadium? And I think that there is that, you know, transparency of the fact that, you know, we really need that big fight. I think if he could have promoted Brock Lesnar and Fedor, he would have put it in a stadium. But, I mean, he's had the option in Montreal to run Olympic Stadium and has chosen not. It's not a great stadium to begin with, just logistics-wise. But, I mean, you have George St. Pierre, and it's like they were not willing to put him into a stadium until they hit that Toronto market. And I think today, I mean, just being here, like, let's just say George St. Pierre and Johnny Hendricks, they rematch, and they put that at the Rogers Center. I don't see that selling 55,000 tickets. You would need something.
I don't know. You would need definitely a stronger undercard. But you're right. Toronto is definitely it's become a bit of a saturated market for.
Like when they run the Air Canada Center, they do very healthy. 13,000-14,000 is great, but it hasn't even completely sold out the Air Canada Center.
Same with the last GSP fights in Montreal.
Yeah, I mean. I just think running a stadium, it's not simple. I think the first time in the market was a big factor in that. And just the UFC being in town was huge. So that was looked at. The Fox deal that they signed in 2011. Women coming into mixed martial arts, or sorry, women coming into the UFC, rather, in 2013. The Strikeforce purchase. And they also had this quote where Bob Meyerowitz was asked by Lorenzo Fertitta when he bought the company, do you think that this can be mainstream? And Meyerowitz said, no, I don't think it can. And to this day, he maintains that he doesn't feel it is mainstream.
What? Okay.
Well, I mean, it's all depends.
I mean, it's on TMZ. The story about George St. Pierre, you know, retiring is on TMZ.
George St. Pierre is on TMZ.
Yeah.
It's like,
what
I don't know.
George St. Pierre?
Is the sport as a whole, I mean, is it?
Yeah, it is. It's totally mainstream. You go to Boston Pizza and they're showing it. How much more mainstream can you get?
Is MMA?
It's on Fox.
MMA isn't even typically the lead story on their broadcast or on Fox Sports Live.
Well, I mean, neither is boxing. Boxing's never a lead story, and would you say that's mainstream?
I wouldn't say boxing as a sport right now is mainstream. Okay. I think two guys are mainstream in boxing. Two people have their attention.
Still representatives of the sport
well,
as a whole.
I mean, it's all very
depends
subjective.
On your definition of mainstream, I guess.
So there you go. That was the documentary, 20 years fighting for a generation. I you know, it was beautifully shot. They had a lot of classic clips, a lot of people that they contacted. I give this documentary, you know, a 6.5, 7 out of 10 maybe.
Yeah, I give it about a 7, 7.5 out of 10. Obviously very well produced. And, I mean, for an hour and a half, you're getting about as much of a concise look at the history of the UFC as you
can. There's a lot of ground to cover.
Yeah.
I think you could have done an easy 2 hours just on the first 3 years of the
UFC. Oh, yeah, no doubt. And for more of that, I'm sure you can listen to the Sure Dog Rewind.
Oh, yes. Jack Encarnacio did a fantastic job leading into this past Saturday show where he reviewed the UFC events in 10-event installments, right through 166, and I did UFC's 121 through 130 with Jack. These are all like 3-hour podcasts.
Yeah.
So if you have a lot of time, I mean, these will take you months probably to get through, but I think they're timeless. You can go back and listen to these anytime. Yeah, a lot of people, Dave Meltzer did one with them, Josh Gross, Ben Fulks, Ariel Helwani, Clyde Gentry, Jeff Sherwood. I mean, just a who's who, really, of people that have covered MMA with different historical perspectives and stuff. So I really recommend checking those out.
Yeah, so overall, I thought a good documentary that, you know, and even for somebody who's already been a fan for a while, a good place to just, like, kind of step back and look back at, you know, wow, like, all this stuff happened. It's been quite a while.
Yeah, it's a fascinating story to look back at this company that, realistically, when you look on paper, so many reasons this thing shouldn't have made it.
Yep.
And to look at it in the health that it has today, it's incredible. Mm-hmm. Like, it really is an incredible story when you figure how much money was lost in the early days, how near it came to shutting down.
Yeah.
I mean, the idea of a night before you're scheduled for UFC 12 in Niagara Falls and you have to board everyone on a plane, fly to Dothan, Alabama because of these rule changes and just let people into the arena for free.
That's crazy.
I mean, it's mind-boggling that's the same company as today that filled the Rogers Center.
And Lorenzo talking about potentially selling the company to what, the owner of ATT?
Yeah, Adam Lambert.
Yeah, and you know, basically at the last minute deciding, you know what, fuck it, I'm losing a lot of money, but let's just see this through, and put a lot of his own money into this reality show, which ended up working for him. So.
Dan Lambert. Adam Lambert's the singer.
Oh, okay.
So anyway.
I wouldn't have known.
Let's go into some feedback right now for the show. We'll start off with Doug from Burlington. My favorite, I asked people for feedback to the documentary or just favorite UFC moments as well. My favorite UFC moment is probably the head kick heard around the world when Gabriel Gonzaga knocked out Mirko Krokop or Forrest Griffin getting destroyed by Anderson Silva. My favorite fight is a tie between the 2009 fight of the year between Clay Guida and Diego Sanchez or Gilbert Melendez, Benson Henderson from this past spring. Yeah, all great fights.
Ray from Alberta. Hey, guys. Thanks for reviewing more MMA. You guys always seem to pick reviews at the right time. First with that Anderson Silva KO corresponding with Like Water, and now the whole Hendricks GSP scoring controversy. Nice timing. I thought this was an excellent documentary. It really focused on the transformation of the UFC from this no-rules human cockfighting spectacle to this global juggernaut and validated and respected sport all around the world. The 1990s were truly the dark ages when it came to MMA, and it's so interesting that we were so close to losing what, in my opinion, is the greatest sport in the world. I'm so thankful for Titas that they were willing to dish out another $10 million to produce The Ultimate Fighter when they could have easily just shut down shop and gone home. I was truly surprised to see John McCain, of all people, make an appearance, but it was nice to see a guy who was so opposed to the UFC saying nice things about it. Overall, great production and awesome documentary. 8 out of 10, only because Frank Shamrock was not mentioned, and he was integral to the UFC's success, in my opinion. To end off, I have a couple questions for you. Has 2013 been the best year of all time for the UFC? And also, what are Ways and John's personal favorite UFC events of all time?
You know, in terms of fights, it's hard to argue with 2013 and the fights that have been produced this year. From going all the way back, March feels like an eternity ago when we saw Carlos Condit and Johnny Hendricks. That was the same month of Brian Stann and Wanderlei Silva with that incredible first round. Melendez-Sanchez, Gustafson-John Jones, even St. Pierre Hendricks.
Yeah, this year's been like really amazing in terms of upsets or near upsets, because
Anderson Silva's lost, yeah. George St. Pierre nearly lost.
Yep, John Jones nearly losing. Yeah. And Benson Henderson losing, so a lot of very eventful things. As far as, you know, favorite events, I mean, I don't really think about events. I think about just more fights on their own. And my favorite fight to this day, Chael Sonnen versus Anderson Silva, number one, which, I mean, Anderson's my favorite guy anyway. But to see him nearly lose after this guy, you know, trash-talking so much, thinking that going into it, we all thought he was just going to get his ass kicked. But then to see him nearly beat Anderson and Anderson pulling through in the end was to me a great moment.
Yeah, as I said, I think Couture Sylvia is my favorite moment.
Do you want to do some MMA trivia?
Oh, as he sent in trivia, let's do it.
Okay. All right. Name the trilogies in which all three fights were for a UFC title or interim title. Hint, there are three.
Okay, well, Chuck Liddell and Randy Couture for the light heavyweight title. All the trilogies that were for a title.
Yeah, or interim title.
Or interim title. Edgar and Maynard, the first one, was not for a title, so that one could not be included. St. Pierre Hughes.
Yes.
That was for the welterweight title. And the third... Huh.
You give up?
Well...
Why don't we go back?
I'm going to say...
Oh, you want a hint? Do you want a hint?
Yeah, give me a hint.
Okay. It took place within the past 3 years.
Ah, I'm going to kick myself when you tell me this.
Can we put Jeopardy music on this?
I don't know. What's the third one?
Velasquez Dos Santos.
Oh, shit. What an idiot.
Name all 11 UFC Hall of Famers.
Oh, Jesus.
Oh, man, this is a long one.
Okay.
Jeez.
Well, Hoyce Gracie, Ken Shamrock, Dan Severn, mm-hmm. Mark Coleman, mm-hmm. Stephen Bonner, Forrest Griffin, mm-hmm. Charles Lewis,
mm-hmm.
Matt Hughes.
Mm-hmm.
How many is that?
I think you're missing three. Three obvious ones.
Three obvious ones. Chuck Liddell.
Uh-huh.
He's gone in. Randy mm-hmm. Couture.
Yeah.
Yeah, I remember.
One very obvious one.
Oh, Christ.
You probably thought you already said it. Maybe you did say it.
Give me 2 seconds here. A very obvious one. Oh, who did they put in last? Oh, Tito Ortiz.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Got them all. Here is a list of fighters. Wade reads out the fighter's name, and John has to guess which fighter handed them their first loss in the UFC.
Jesus.
As fast as he can. This is tough, man.
As fast as I can, too. Fuck.
Chuck Liddell.
Jeremy Horn.
Randy Couture.
It would have been Ensign Inoue.
He doesn't have that here, but...
No, that's probably wrong. What's the answer?
Josh Barnett, he wrote. I trust you.
Ensign Inoue he lost to.
Okay.
We'll double check as we continue.
Okay. George St. Pierre.
Matt Hughes.
Yep. Rich Franklin.
For first loss. Was it Anderson Silva?
That's what he writes.
Okay. Well, we have to go with what he says.
What's the answer with Randy?
Oh, Ensign Inoue was actually Valley Tudo Japan show. So there you go.
Michael Bisping.
First loss. Well, he had a draw with Rashad Evans, didn't he?
Was that a draw?
No, it was a loss. It was a loss.
There you go.
It was a very close fight. 78.
Oh my God, this is really long. Fuck. Okay, we'll just.
We'll pick one or two.
We'll do one more.
Okay, one more.
BJ Penn.
BJ Penn's first loss is to Jens Pulver.
Yeah, you got
famous it. Fight UFC 35. One of my favorite.
It was
events.
About a 95% score on your test.
Well, there you go.
A plus.
All right, we will continue here. Here, why don't you read the next one? Because
we go to Jordan from Saskatoon, who says, "My first UFC event, the Tough 13 finale. My first fight, Clay Guida versus Anthony Pettis. My favorite fight was Hendo versus Shogun at UFC 139. My favorite UFC moment is UFC 148. I was with a group of my friends, and I ended up being the only Chael Sonnen fan with them. After the first round, I started to talk a massive amount of shit about Anderson Silva. This came to bite me in the ass after he got knocked out."
Dave from Allentown. "Hi, guys. First of all, let me say it's refreshing to hear a UFC show being reviewed. I know you guys don't do that often for fear of alienating some of the audience, but please don't be afraid to do more. Documentary was a fascinating insight, although there were a lot of obvious omissions from it for someone like myself who only got into UFC and MMA in general within the last 3 years. As a lifelong pro wrestling fan, a couple of years ago, my friends tried getting me to watch UFC via The Ultimate Fighter, but I wasn't really interested. I was like many of the ignorant during the early years of UFC, who thought it was too violent and bloody, and to be honest, I preferred the safeness of WWE, where I knew the majority of times the guys weren't getting hurt. It also didn't help that I had no TV channels over in Dublin, Ireland that would show the UFC pay-per-views, as that's all there was available at the time. It wasn't until moving to America last year and the availability of plenty of coverage on Fox, watching the pay-per-views at a decent time of 10 p.m. as opposed to 3 a.m. in Dublin, and listening to you guys and other podcasts like the MMA Hour and Joe Rogan, that I truly became a fan. I understood the sport more and more and what it takes to be a fighter and the tremendous athletic ability it takes, which impressed me immensely. Of course, some personality is needed, and the primetime and countdown shows do a really great job of that and have even made my wife a fan so much that she knows a lot of the fighters. One of her favorite fighters is Johnny Hendricks, not so much because of his great knockout skills, but on one of the primetime episodes months ago, showed him being a great dad, which really resonated with her, so that proves these shows have a purpose. Favorite UFC moment is probably when Anderson Silva got knocked out. I will always remember where I was when that happened and how shocked and happy I was," and gives a seven skinny head full of hair Joe Rogan's out of 10 to this documentary.
Yeah, he was much skinnier back then. Chris in China says, "I have two UFC-related questions for you guys. Since I'm more of a pro wrestling fan than fight fan, I wanted to get your thoughts on how Brock Lesnar compared as a fighter to other all-time great heavyweights in the UFC. Where would you rank him?"
I wouldn't have him in the top tier of all-time heavyweight fighters. I mean, his drawing ability is without question. In terms of his skill set, I think that what he really needed was a more solid base of just striking.
Time.
That guy needed to go to Thailand for a year or something and learn Muay Thai, and he wasn't at a stage in his life where he was going to do that. Certainly got by with tremendous wrestling and made huge advances for the limited time. I mean, the guy was a freak athlete. Uh-huh. But to look at him, I mean, there is a disparity between a guy like him and Cain Velasquez, for instance.
Oh, absolutely.
When it comes to athletic heavyweights.
His second question is, who do you think is the Sting of MMA? That meaning, who is the greatest fighter that the top dog UFC could never get? I think the obvious pick would be Fedor, but what other names come to mind?
Fedor was certainly the one everyone wanted to see come in. You know, outside of that, it's hard to say that there's really, you know, Josh Barnett's there now. It's not like you have any fighters that really came and went that the UFC was like the lesser for not having. I mean, maybe you want to say Eddie Alvarez today, but, you know, 6 months from now, he very well could be in there. I think Fedor is the most glaring one that, you know, it produces the most, you know, what could have been when it comes to fights.
Mm-hmm.
Is that it?
Yeah.
Jake from the UK. I'd have to say my favorite UFC moment is probably the whole UFC 100 card. There was so much hype around that show, and Brock Lesnar was at his finest. In the UK, the UFC was in between channels and stations and found a temporary home on a random horse racing channel. Didn't make much sense, but it was great. They had like 5 or 6 hours of build-up hyping the fights on the pay-per-view and showed some of the UFC's greatest moments. It was an incredible show all in all and signified the UFC's biggest buy rate in history.
We go to Brad from St. John's, Newfoundland, who says, "Hey guys, I checked out the UFC 20 year anniversary and thought they did a great job covering the entire history of the UFC. I remember renting VHSs of the first few UFC events during my teenage years, but didn't become a hardcore fan until the first season of The Ultimate Fighter and watching the rematch of Liddell versus Couture. I never realized how much was riding on that first season of The Ultimate Fighter, especially the main event of the finale, which essentially kept the company from shutting down. Too many great fights to pick a favorite. But a few moments that stand out to me where I jumped out of my chair were Matt Serra knocking out GSP, Weidman knocking out Silva, and Chael Sonnen's 4.5-round domination of Anderson Silva in their first match together."
Jason in Milwaukee, "This was great. The production value was top-notch, and they covered the 20-year history perfectly. My favorite parts were the coverage of the start of the UFC, the failure of UFC 33, and the great success and awesomeness of UFC 100. I loved all the talking heads they got on the show to discuss the history, but was disappointed at the lack of Dave Meltzer. 9 Hoist Gracie submission holds out of 10. My favorite UFC memory was attending 164 in Milwaukee and seeing hometown boy Anthony Pettis beat Ben Henderson for the lightweight title."
Royce, not Hoist, from California. "Hey guys, let me get right to it. I have to say I really enjoyed the UFC doc, even as a guy who doesn't really watch MMA. I think it was very interesting to see the rise, near fall, and rise again of the company. I especially enjoyed hearing about the earlier, more freak show years of the company and how they had to add more rules and basically become a sport just to stay in business, to fend off critics of the genre. Overall, I give this doc 9 Pollock impressions of Silva out of 10. P.S. I have a question in the doc. They go over how UFC bought a lot of the other MMA federations, but I couldn't help but think about the WWE, who basically did the same thing wrestling-wise, and I got to thinking that the UFC and the WWE are arguably number one in their respective genres in terms of popularity and visibility, and spike both the far and distant number two in both genres with TNA and Bellator, I think he means. So I would like to ask you guys, since you two are so knowledgeable about both, in which genre do you think lays the bigger gap between 1 and 2, WWE to TNA or UFC to Bellator?"
Geez, I think it's just about equal. I think TNA and Bellator are, you know, pretty much exact replicas of each other's respective space in each industry at this point. I mean, you have a really far and distant number one that is out ahead of number two. I don't think we're ever going to see in our lifetime a company eclipse either WWE or UFC in terms of space in their industries.
I mean, I would put TNA slightly ahead because they do some pay-per-view. Bellator is still kind of new on Spike TV, and I would say probably a little less traction to the casual fan than maybe TNA does have with the casual wrestling fan. But overall, I agree with you. It's a huge gap.
All right, so thanks, everyone, for your feedback. This was a fun show to do, right? Switching it up a little and looking at this. Maybe we should just start doing this every week.
Sure.
Yeah, so starting next week, we'll go UFC 3, and we'll just keep going.
Why don't we start from, 3, and then
we've done 1 and 2. You can go back to our archives, everyone. We do have reviews of UFC 1 and 2. With UFC 1, we even had Ken Shamrock on the show. So if you want to hear from Ken Shamrock, review away is your forum to hear all about the behind the scenes of that very first show. And he's got some great stories. It was like 45 minutes I chatted with him for that particular review. So you can go back. That one we did in like May of 2011. So you can go back and check that out. But next week we are looking ahead. The month of November is coming to a close. And what are you thinking would be a good review for next week? Is there anything you feel like watching?
Hey, when is our contest?
Our contest is...
Let's talk about the contest. Plug the contest one more time.
Yeah, we are doing a giveaway of WWE 2K14 for the Xbox 360. The rules are really simple. Create a 30-second video that is pro wrestling inspired. Post it online to wherever, YouTube, Daily Motion, whatever you would like. Tweet it out at Law Radio and use the hashtag Law2K14. There's also a thread up on the message board where you can post it as well. And just post the video, and then next week on Review and Impact. Let's do it on Review and Impact.
So next Friday, What's the date of that?
The deadline will be Thursday.
The 28th?
Thursday, November 28th is your deadline to get the videos in. Then on Review and Impact, me and Way are going to go through the videos. We're going to pick our finalists. Way will pick one, I'll pick one, and then they're going to duke it out on Title Bout Trivia that Sunday, and the winner gets the game. Simple enough. We already have one out there of a guy with a cigarette cutting a promo.
I like that. Nice and simple.
That's where the bar has been set right now. So 30 seconds, hashtag Law2K14. We'll find the video. So you have just over a week to get those on over to us. So Way, next week's review, though. What are you feeling like?
Oh,
give
man.
Me a company
okay.
that you feel like reviewing. Anything.
Company. I want to review... like a popular company?
Just give me an organization that you want to review, and we're going to systematically break it down. I'm going to do a series of questions that are going to lead to an event.
Okay. I mean, I actually want to review something more obscure.
Okay. Well, why don't you just say what you want to review next week?
I'd like to review maybe like a... But I just don't think people are going to find it even.
Oh, all right. Well, can we find it?
I don't even know.
Okay, well, then maybe those are not the best ones to pick for us, because then sometimes we have to change the review.
Okay. Why don't we review, how about a Mexican promotion?
We could do that.
That sounds like a no.
Well, it's just idea. Again, it's finding some of this stuff. Way some of this stuff is extremely obscure.
How about a Australian promotion?
How about we do this? You know what we're gonna do? This is going to be.
John Pollock is pulling up Twitter right now.
What should we review next week on Review Away? And me and Way are not going to end this podcast until someone answers. Are okay. we willing to no,
yeah,
review the first answer that comes
yeah,
back?
Yeah, so write down the first response well, it gets to be reviewed that we haven't done yet. We have to be prepared. It could be anything. It could be another porno. It could be...
What should we review next week on Review Away? Answer ASAP and we'll do it.
Okay.
This is going to be...
All right. Here's the countdown. Keep refreshing.
Okay. Let's see here.
Well, as we wait for our first review, this is the first time we've ever done this.
I know. This is kind of cool. Yeah. I'm excited here about what the first interaction is.
I think people are going to get by their computers around whenever they guess that we might record this.
We might be on here for another hour.
I know.
Who knows? Yeah, how popular are we on Twitter? Listens. That's going to be the question.
Yeah, no response.
Yeah, I see you're supporting our mayor there with your water bottle.
Yes, I do have.
It's got the Ford.
I have a Ford
logo on it. Oh,
our first interaction.
Are you ready?
Yeah,
that was fast. Survivor Series 2007.
Have we done that?
No, we have not.
Okay,
we have to do it.
We have to.
That
do
was
it.
The rules.
Yeah.
Okay, so if anyone has a problem with that, get upset at NickMoney07, who wants to review Survivor Series 2007. So that's coming up next week on the show. In the meantime, go to liveaudiowrestling.com. Subscribe to The Law, Live Audio Wrestling on iTunes, at Way0937.
Just out of curiosity, what's the second response?
Money in the Bank 2010 or Survivor Series 2007
oh,
would be
go.
Great. So
there
it's overwhelming
go.
Now.
Yeah.
As well, Way, you can follow us at Law Radio. We are now on Instagram officially.
Oh.
At Law Radio on Instagram. It is being run by our own Braden Harrington. He's figured out Instagram. So there, go take a look.
What are we going to see? What photos can we see?
I don't know. But if there are lack of photos, then get on at Joker Radio and bother him for a lack of photos, because it's now his job to run it all.
Yeah, like I don't see anything right now. Has he posted anything?
He's been given this task most recently, so let's give him at least.
I want to see a constant update.
Well, he's gonna we're gonna have to light a fire under him to get that Instagram account going.
Yeah.
All right, we're gonna get on out of here, but we'll be back later this week. If you missed The Law from Sunday night, special edition Law Country.
Law Country, yes.
Great lead-in for Monday's Raw, mm-hmm. which we also have debuted or reviewed. And that is up at liveaudiowrestling.com, The Law from this past week. Full interview with Brian Williams with all of your listener questions as well. Some interesting stuff about the WWE 2K14 video game. Review of Raw is up. The MMA report will be up on Thursday along with a new edition of What's Next. Bauer and Pollock. Review and Impact. Lots of stuff going on, Way. It's a busy, busy world.
Mm-hmm.
Are you watching Survivor Series this weekend?
Maybe. I don't know.
You shouldn't.
Yeah, that might be a
especially after Raw Monday.
Call.
Are you really that interested?
Actually, I'm more interested now after Raw on Monday.
All right. We're going to get on out of here. I'm getting a lot of responses now from people.
Yeah,
so
you should end the contest.
What can we possibly end with? Mr. Ting, a song that really
encapsulates the 20 years.
You know what I think really it sums everything up?
A Jump Around by House of Pain.
No, I think we should go out with the theme to Mortal Kombat.
Oh, yes, of course.
This was what this started the controversy.
This is your favorite song.
I do. It's on my iPod.
Who is actually the artist? Who does this song?
Is that his name?
No, who
Oh, I thought you said Woo is the artist.
No, it just sounded...
Well, that's a weird name.
That's my accent.
I really don't know who does it at all.
It's just a Mortal Kombat theme.
I don't know.
This song still gets people hype.
Yes. Who does not get inspired when they're asked to test their might?
Yes.
All right, we're going to get on out of here, and we will chat with you all later this week. And then next week, Survivor Series 2007. Test your might.